Did you want to show it there?
Well, just for this. Okay. Just for this. This is Victor Cunicelli of the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission. Today's date is April 22, 2010. The time is approximately 10 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. I am accompanied by Bruce McWilliams of the FCIC and Tom Borgers via telephone and Jerome Fons. We are at the offices of the FCIC in Washington, D.C. for the interview of Mr. Fons. This interview will be recorded with the consent of Mr. Fons. Mr. Fons, could I please get your verbal consent to that?
Sure. That's fine.
Okay. Will everyone please state your full name and affiliation for the record, and please spell your last name for the transcriptionist. Why don't we start with you, Mr. McWilliams?
Bruce McWilliams, MCWILLIAMS, and I'm an investigator with the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission.
Fantastic. Mr. Borgers?
It's Tom Borgers, that's B as in boy, O-R-G-E-R-S. I'm also a senior investigator with the commission.
Okay. Cunicelli is C-U-N-I-C-E-L-L-I. My first name is Victor, and I'm an investigator with the commission. And Mr. Fons, if you would.
I'm Jerome Fons. That's F as in Frank, O as in Oscar, N as in Nancy, S as in Sam. And I am an independent consultant, though I'm an advisor with K2 Global Partners.
Okay. In the way of background, Mr. Fons, the FCIC was established by statute and signed into law by the President. It's bipartisan and consists of 10 commissioners. It is charged with examining the causes of the financial crisis and collapse or near collapse of major domestic financial institutions. The commission is charged with composing a report of findings to the President and Congress by 15 December 2010. The commission may compel attendance and testimony of witnesses and production of records. I can provide a copy of the statute by which the commission was formed, if you so desire. Please let me know, and I'd be more than happy to do that, sir.
No, I could probably find that online.
Okay, super. And by the way, our website is www.fcic.gov, and I would advise you to go there. You could find out a good bit more information about the commission there. Please be advised that the FCIC is an agency of the United States, and FCIC staff are federal employees under the aegis of 18 United States Code, Section 1001. That's a criminal statute concerning false statements. False statements can be problematic, so I would, of course, urge your candor. That's it as far as the introduction, sir. If you could, what I would ask you to do is just give me a brief biography of yourself, and why don't you start with where you went to college and that sort of thing.
Certainly. I received my bachelor's degree in economics from San Diego State University, and then I earned my PhD in economics from University of California in San Diego. I finished that in 1985. My dissertation topic there was on pricing risky corporate debt. So my interest was in high yield bonds and credit risk. I worked, my first job after the Fed was with the Federal Reserve Bank of Cleveland. After college, Federal Reserve Bank of Cleveland from 85 to about 88, beginning 88. In 1988, I moved to the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. I was an economist there as well. I spent almost 2 years at the New York Fed before I jumped ship. I went to Chemical Bank in New York in 89, and then in fall of 90, I was recruited to Moody's Investor Service to author their corporate bond default studies. So I joined Moody's in October of 1990. As a senior analyst, I did the default study work for about 4 years. I was the lead author on the corporate bond default study, which was sort of a marketing and analytic tool to help people understand what the historic performance of ratings had been in the corporate sector, looking over various time horizons, so they could compare the historic loss of a single B, say, with a AAA rated bond or issuer. And in 1994, I switched into the structured finance area. I spent 2 years rating residential mortgage pass-through securities. As an economist, a senior, sort of a rating, a mortgage economist, but really I was there to help provide analytic oversight to the, and it helped write a methodology that was published for rating residential mortgage pass-throughs I did that until 1996. And in 1996, I was promoted to managing director and then took responsibility for rating East Asian banks. So I completely left the structured area. And I also, sometime around 2000 or 99, took over responsibility for regulatory affairs, which meant being a contact point, a person for with the SEC and European regulators who were interested in rating agency issues. In about 2001, I became managing director of credit policy for all corporate financial institutions and sovereign ratings. And that was really helping set rating standards and practices for rating corporates and other securities. And I left in August 2007. There was a reorganization. We can get into that later. But I left in August 2007, and then I became at that point, I started doing independent consulting. I was aligned with Gerson Lehrman Group. You've probably heard of them and who they are. And spent a lot of time in the fall.
Can you repeat the name of that, please? What was the name?
Gerson Lehrman, Gerson Lehrman Group, GLG.
Mr. Fonz, yes. I was a little remiss. When I'm recording, I give you some ground rules. If you mention a proper name, please make your best attempt to spell it, even names
okay.
that you're not sure about. I'm sure your educated guess is probably better than ours. And
okay.
What I'll probably do, best practice, is that people don't remember the first few times, so we'll probably prompt you for spellings the first few
okay,
times.
Okay, no problem.
Okay. Second
okay.
thing, especially we're on a long-distance telephone line, I'm going to try to the extent we can, we're going to give you narrative questions and we're going to let you fully answer them. If we ask a question, please don't crop it. Don't start answering until we're done. Let us get the question out just for the purpose of a clean transcript.
Understood.
All right. Thanks an awful lot.
Okay.
So go ahead. I'm sorry. You were...
Gerson Lehrman Group, it's a very large expert network company. GERSONLERMANGRUP. You can find them online. But they cater to hedge funds and banks and financial institutions and fixed income investors and provide access to experts on various topics. And my expertise at that time and still is was rating agencies. And so I went and spent time speaking to their clients in London, New York, Boston, California. And through the course of that, I put my thoughts down and wrote a white paper on structured finance and rating competition, and that was published in Journal of Structured Finance. And then since last October, I have been working with Jules Kroll, K-R-O-L-L. He's the investigator from Kroll Associates and Kroll Inc. Jules has expressed an interest in starting a rating agency, and I've been working with him as an advisor. The company is called K2 Global Partners. That's K is in K, 2 is in letter 2, number 2, Global Partners, GOLBALPARTNERS. And we are located in Manhattan, and we are currently putting together, trying to form a viable rating firm.
Okay. If I could, you know, what I'm principally interested in, of course, is your time at Moody's.
Mm-hmm.
So, could I draw your attention to, if we could go back to, fall of 90, I just want to dig down a little bit about your assignments at Moody's.
Okay.
Your first job title at Moody's, what was it?
Senior analyst.
Okay. And which group were you in, sir, as a senior analyst?
That would have been the industrials group.
Okay, and what would have been
part of the corporate department?
Part of the corporate department. Would you have had rating responsibilities then?
You know, I was given some responsibilities for a small group of defaulted high yield companies. My primary responsibilities were to, as we said, to write the corporate bond default studies, but I was immersed in the rating team. I reported to a managing director, Andrew Kimball, K-I-M-B-A-L-L, who now heads Structured Finance at Moody's. And we, you know, I was also there to help them with respect to their methodologies and, you know, providing them statistical tools to help them rate companies.
Okay.
But as far as rating responsibility, I was involved in rating committees, but I was a lead analyst for only a handful of small firms.
Okay. Question for you. My understanding is that a lot of times at Moody's, analysts were kind of teamed up on projects, that a quantitative analyst and a legal analyst would kind of work with one another. Were you quantitative or legal? Or?
Well, I mean, my background is an economist, so I feel I was considered more quantitative than the average person there. When you say teams, legal, that on project, when you say projects, you know, the main function of Moody's and the analysts at Moody's is to maintain, assign and maintain ratings. And so each company or issuer would typically be assigned a lead analyst. And the rating itself would be assigned by a rating committee. The analyst would present to a rating committee his recommendation or her recommendation, but the committee ultimately would vote on and assign a rating. That's the practice today and it has been at the rating firm since I joined.
Okay, super. How long were you in this senior analyst position?
As I mentioned, I continued to lead author the corporate bond default study through about to 1994, but my title, I think I became a vice president somewhere along there, like 93 or 4, you know, something like that, 94 maybe.
Okay. And you became a managing director in 96?
That's correct.
How did your responsibilities change as a vice president, or were they still largely the same, largely analytical?
Largely the same. I mean, I had a staff under me, which was unusual, again, for a vice president, but I, you know, yeah, I mean, they were largely the same.
Okay, and you were still largely rating companies at this time?
My main job was to write and promote the corporate bond default study, but I was deeply immersed in what was at the time called the speculative grade ratings group, which was part of the team, speculative grade ratings team, which was part of the industrial group, and helping to train analysts and to provide tools for analysts to rate companies, statistical tools. I was building models for rating companies. We were implementing feeds, data feeds, financial statements, and market information. Things like this. So I had a number of my job was to help make the ratings better and help to articulate what ratings were and how they performed. And Moody's sent me to Tokyo. They sent me to Australia, all over Europe. I had a 9-city tour across Europe in early 94. In 93, I'd gone to Asia. And, you know, so I mean, I was really a sort of ambassador for the firm, explaining, you know, what ratings were and how they performed.
Okay. In 2001, you moved to corporate credit.
In 2001, I became head of credit policy.
Head of credit policy,
which was a new position, but you know, there we were focused on raising the bar with respect to our methodologies, our published methodologies for rating companies.
But Mr. Fons, let's go back a step. I have a note. In 1994, you went to the structured finance area, right?
That's correct.
That's probably where our interest becomes more by. I mean, tell us a little bit what happened there.
Well, in structured finance, as I mentioned, I was in the residential mortgage-backed securities group. At the time, we were mainly rating prime mortgages, although there were probably some subprime, the very few issuance at that time. But my job there was to be part of a rating team. I was given a portfolio, a small portfolio there as well. Again, my role was sort of as an advisor economist rather than your typical analyst. Many of the analysts there were lawyers. You mentioned there the legal people. Many of the analysts, half of the analysts in structured finance back at that time were attorneys by background.
Right.
The other half were, you know, a little more quantitative, I'll put it that way. But there were some quantitative attorneys as well. So my role was as an economist to keep an eye on the housing market, trends in the housing market, and to the extent that was had any bearing on ratings, to, you know, bring that to attention of the team or group. And then also, as I mentioned, it was to put in writing and to create a methodology, a published methodology for rating residential mortgage-backed securities.
Okay. So you were part of the that's pretty early on in the mortgage-backed security market, no?
Yes, it was, and I would say it was at a time when, although Fitch was trying to enter the market, Fitch FITCH Investor Service at the time was trying to enter the market. It was still mainly dominated by Moody's and Standard & Poor's.
Okay.
S&P. And I'd say there was a heavy focus on quality analytics, on doing a good job, you know, getting the rating right.
Let me ask you, you know, I've talked to a couple people from Moody's, and a little bit of information can be dangerous, but I understand that early on, maybe, one of the models that came out of or that was in use a lot was the BET, binomial expansion. Was that the model that ultimately you started using, or is this something prior to that?
First of all, the model you refer to, this technique, was designed to help rate CDOs.
Okay.
Collateralized debt obligations.
Right.
And those were composed of various securities, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Could be loans or other things. So I was not involved in that directly. I should also say that around 2002, Moody's created something called the Structured Credit Committee as a parallel to what we had in the fundamental. We use the word fundamental to refer to corporate financial institutions and sovereigns. And everything else was structured finance. Municipals would also fall under fundamental municipal securities. And we had a committee called a Fundamental Credit Committee, which was an arm of the Credit Policy Committee. I was a member of the Credit Policy Committee, and I was chair of the Fundamental Credit Committee from about 2002 or 3 until I left the firm. Structured finance started an analogous entity called the Structured Credit Committee around 2003 until I left. And I was a member of that.
Who headed that?
That was chaired, ultimately it was headed by Brian Clarkson.
Okay.
But I'd say Noel Kernan was really more the point person, because Brian attended the first few times and then stopped. So I would say that Noel Kernan was really the de facto chair.
Okay, I appreciate
it. KIRNON.
I appreciate you pointing out my misunderstanding. If I could, what I'd like to go back to 94, to your early, I guess, RMBS model?
Yep.
Okay, because I didn't mean to draw you up to 2001 with my misunderstanding of the...
Okay, no problem. No problem.
So...
Just a little history. The first CDO model, as far as I know, was created by Douglas Lucas, L-U-C-A-S. And that was probably around 1990, and he introduced a binomial model for rating collateralized loan obligations initially, I believe. Okay. So I'll go back to 1994. I was working in the RMBS area. By 96, we had finished the first, actually someone tells me now it might have been the second, published residential mortgage pass-through model. And that stayed in place, as far as I know, until around 2000, when, for whatever reason, they decided to update that model. You could say it's because they had more data, but I think many people believe that they updated it because it was costing the company market share.
Oh.
And so they needed a new model that would be a little more, if you will, less conservative.
Okay.
That would allow lower enhancement levels.
Let me ask you, you said that other people believe that. Do you believe it yourself, sir?
Well, I could not speak directly to that because I did not investigate it. I did not, did not compare them side by side to see. I didn't have access to the actual model itself, so I had no way to verify this because I was no longer in the structured finance area.
Okay.
Was in a position to judge the quality of, loan pools that they were seeing, that they were rating, to know that there was a material difference.
Your original model, did it have a name like BET or?
No. It was just our methodology, the residential mortgage backed securities methodology.
And let me ask you, I guess any model is as good as the assumptions that you start out with. Can you recall with any specificity what your assumptions were for that early RMBS model and where you would have derived them?
Let me characterize it this way. The goal of the model, and I use the word model in a number of different ways, I suppose, and model and research are probably the two most abused words on Wall Street. But I'd say that what we did was we used an approach that tried to capture the best that we could the risk in mortgage securities based on various characteristics of the underlying pool, as well as information about the service originator and servicer. So what we tried to do was provide our best estimate of the loss distribution for any given pool that we were faced with. And that what we did was looked at history. We had a data file that showed default delinquency and loss characteristics for loans going back in time, sorted by various characteristics. So we could match characteristics to historical loss performance. So our main assumption, if you will, if anything, would be that the future would look something like the past.
Okay.
I mean that would be the closest to an assumption I would say that we made.
All right. So basically, you were assuming that default rates or performance rates would mirror past rates.
That's right. And we did take into account, severe times as well. Bad economic times as well as good economic times. We weren't just assuming that it was all going to be rosy.
Is that, would you call that stressing in the model?
Yeah, I mean, I think Standard & Poor's uses that word more than we did, but we considered other scenarios.
Okay.
It's analogous to stressing, but no, we didn't stress the portfolio. We just tried to capture, we tried to gather data from as broad a sample as we could, which would have included, poor economic times as well as good times.
Okay. And when exactly did you leave the structured area?
That would have been November 1st or thereabouts, 1996.
1996. And that's it. Okay. So 94 to 96, you put this model together for rating RMBS.
That's
and,
correct.
And that model is basically the model that Moody's uses until about 2000.
That's my understanding.
Okay. Bruce, did you want to?
Yeah, that's fine.
Did you want to go to 2001?
Well, then I have in 2000 you changed gears and became in charge of regulatory affairs?
I took over regulatory affairs for someone who had that job full-time, so it was added to my responsibilities because as rating East Asian banks, it was a relatively small group. I was based in New York. I traveled a lot to Asia, but, you know, it just required less time on my part. I was a managing director. I had about 11 to 15 analysts under me, and I was involved in rating committees and reviewing their research and traveling with them to meet companies, but I wasn't, you know, doing a lot of, you know, heavy lifting beyond that. So they dropped on me regulatory affairs.
Okay. What the rating committees that you were on, what were you rating at that time?
And from 96 to 2001, I was rating East Asian banks,
okay,
including Japanese banks.
I'm sorry, I screwed up a little bit. I'm taking notes here. In 96, you stopped doing structured finance?
That's correct.
Okay, and that's then when you started East Asian banks. Okay.
That's correct.
Okay, so East Asian banks. And then in 2001, you're put as the head of credit policy.
That's right, where I was no longer responsible for ratings on any particular sector, or you know, but generally responsible for practices and policies and rating quality across all corporate and financial institutions and sovereign. And around 2005 or 4, I was essentially co-head of the sovereign rating group. Okay. I spent most of my I took part responsibility for rating sovereign issuers from then until 2000. Until I left in 2007. Okay. So I worked with the, I was on every almost every rating committee for sovereign issuers.
So when you say sovereign issuers?
That's companies, that's countries. That's France, Germany, okay. Japan, Great Britain, Greece.
Excellent.
Iceland.
Okay, excellent. Could you tell me a little bit about your day-to-day duties during that time, I guess 01 to 05?
07, until I left in 07 or 05?
Did you stay in that job, the head of credit, through 07?
Yes.
Okay, why don't you do that?
I mean, day-to-day, I chaired the Fundamental Credit Committee, which met like at least once a month. Responsible for the agenda for that committee. I was a member of the Credit Policy Committee, which probably met once every 3 months. I managed a team, and part of the things I was doing was building statistical models of ratings. And I did a lot of writing. I wrote papers. I trained analysts. So I helped develop a methodology for rating subordinated bonds versus senior bonds, for example. And these were rating practices or policies that affected all companies and all ratings that Moody's had on companies or financial institutions. You know, things, you know, how do we look at preferred stock? I was also chair of the Rating Symbols and Definitions Committee. So the current Moody's rating symbols definitions that you read, AAA, lowest minimal credit risk, and so forth, those definitions, I wrote those. And my committee, and I chaired the committee that approved those, and I had to approve every new rating symbol or system that Moody's used throughout the organization.
Okay.
So my hands were in a lot of high level policy and practices issues that affected the, you know, communication of ratings, and so anyway, I'll leave it at that.
Okay. You certainly seem to be a wealth of historical information for Moody's coming there in 90, which we don't find every day. So I'd like to get your perspective. There's been a lot in the media about the culture at Moody's changing at some point. And I just wanted to gauge your opinion on that, whether there was a cultural change, you know, yes or no, whether you felt there was, and if so, when that started and how it kind of evinced itself.
You're absolutely right. And I'll go a little bit further. Towards the last year or two that I was at Moody's, we embarked on a project of putting together a historical summary of the company's history. In fact, there is a document that I have that is not published, but we hired an editor who was an ex-editor at Moody's, and I was the archivist, if you will, keeping historical artifacts, old manuals, documents. We were in charge of the history of the company. My boss and I. My boss was Christopher Mahoney. M A H O N E Y.
Okay. How long?
I'm sorry.
How long were you reporting to Mr. Mahoney?
From 96 to the day I left. Okay. Well, actually, by the time I left, within a month before I left, Chris got a new job, and I started to report back to Andrew Kimball. Like for the last month before I left.
Okay. This kind of history that you were putting together of the company,
yes.
Did it have a name, a title?
It was Moody's, I have it at home, 100 years, it was like the first 100 years, Moody's the first 100 years, something like that.
Okay. Would you have an electronic version of that you could...
I do not have an electronic. I have an electronic version of some of the chapters. Because again, I was I was managing the project, and the company squashed it. So it was a print run was made. I have a copy of it, it documents a lot. But let's go back to the culture just for a second.
Sure, sure.
I thought I was pretty. Frank about this in my testimony. I testified before the House Oversight Committee in 2008, October 22nd. It was before Waxman's committee.
Mm-hmm.
I was the first witness on a panel on a day devoted to rating agencies.
Right.
And in my testimony, I refer to a change in culture that I believe took place somewhere around 95 to 96, but probably closer to 98 is when it really started to take hold. And part of it, as I allude to in my testimony, was sparked by the publication of an article in, I believe it was Treasury and Risk Magazine. I have the exact date and the author's name of the article. But it was something like Rating the Rating Agencies was the name of the article. On the front of the magazine, I think there was a subheading that said, Why Everyone Hates Moody's. Or maybe it was just a subheading to the article.
Right.
And the article was a survey of corporate treasurers. Okay, not investors, but corporate treasurers. And these are people who Moody's, typically have to interact with Moody's rating analysts when Moody's is rating the company that... a particular company. So the treasurers, the interest of corporate treasurers obviously is theoretically to get a good rating and to deal with, an easy rating company. Okay. And the results of the survey in the article was that Moody's was the most difficult firm to work with. Their analysts were least responsive. It was just the most unpleasant experience possible working with Moody's. And now some folks at Moody's would look at that with a source of pride because, since 1970, actually 69 for some sectors, the rating agencies were charging the rated issuers for their ratings. And Moody's, and if you look at this document, if I ever give you a draft of this paper, you'll see that back as early as the 1950s, Moody's vowed that they would never, ever charge an issuer for a rating. Because that would create a conflict of interest. So the culture that I joined the firm at in 1990 was one in which we were highly attuned to the potential conflict, but under the head of corporate department at the time, whose name was Tom McGuire, that's M-C-G-U-I-E-I-R-E, Thomas McGuire, we had a very strong focus on the investor, and you know, issuers were just, you know, they were there, you know, but they're not to be trusted. They're not to be catered to. They're not to be pandered to. And so we had a kind of, you know, I'd say it was a
professional distance.
Professional distance. Yeah, I mean, describing the relationship we have with issuers. It was, you know, they'd come in and they'd sit and have to be grilled by some young kid, you know, that they didn't respect, who may not, you know their industry as well as they did, that probably knew pretty well, and or in some cases older people, you know, not just kids, but you know, it was a CEO coming in or a chief financial officer coming in and being, you know, interrogated, and you know, this is not the world that the CEOs like to be in. You know, they like to be sort of running the show and being, you know, being in charge. And so I think, you know, our culture was one in which we put investors' interests first. The issuers, you know, we were never there to make them happy. And so they considered us unresponsive, or, you know, we didn't get it, you know, or other things. I mean, they just didn't, it just wasn't a fun experience for them. And so this came through in this survey. Well, to many people, to some people at the firm, and probably to the owners of Moody's at the time, which was done in Bradstreet, D&B, D-U-N-N-B-R-A-D-S-T-R-E-E-T, done in Bradstreet, was the corporate parent of Moody's. They had bought the company in 1947, something like that, maybe 1950, 51. They owned the firm. There was a love-hate relationship between Moody's and its parent, Dun & Bradstreet, at the time as well. Dun & Bradstreet was not terribly profitable. Moody's was their cash cow, and so Moody's earnings and revenues went straight to Dun & Bradstreet's coffers, and they did little investment in the firm. You know, they didn't, you know, and there was not much respect either way. So Dun & Bradstreet, the owners of Moody's, you know, also probably saw this article, and they're saying, well, what the heck is this? You know, everyone hates Moody's. You know, that's not a good business. That's no way to treat your customers, the customers being the issuers. You know, we got to fix this.
Move this along.
So this was seen as a problem, the fact that the corporate treasurers didn't like us so much. And so a number of initiatives started to take place at the firm to become more, quote, issuer friendly.
Okay.
And with that, the culture started to change. So that's just the start of it.
Okay. And when would you, 94, you say this started roughly?
I'd say this article came in 95.
95. And
yeah.
Who were the architects of change?
Well, that's a good question. I think a number of people were put in charge of the initiative. I mean, there were several initiatives. One of them was sort of a sensitivity training, if you will, of analysts. We had to go to these meetings on how to listen well and how, you know, be effective listeners and, you know, things like this. And literally, it was the business heads in each of the groups that took responsibility for this.
For the culture change.
For the culture change, yeah.
And who, some names of some of these business heads, I guess managing directors?
Well, I mean, Moody's had gone, another event happened in 1996. There was a historical separation of power within Moody's between the corporate department, and by the corporate department at that time, which I was part of, had industrials, financial institutions, and structured finance. Structured finance was in the corporate department.
Right.
The other major rating area was municipals. I mean, sovereigns was also under corporates. The municipals. And there was a siloed effect going on there, the municipal group versus corporate. But during the early 1990s, the municipal market started, was really not doing too well, and the municipal ratings group wasn't doing too well. And there was a lot of friction between the corporate and municipal group. And so Dun & Bradstreet brought in McKinsey & Company to look at this dysfunctional organization. And what they decided was that they needed to reorganize it, and with that, they fired Tom McGuire, although he'll say he resigned, the head of the municipal group, Dan Heimowitz, I think was his name, and they merged everything into one ratings group. And so we had, in 96, in I believe it was around March or May of 1996, we had a complete, and through the summer, we had a complete reorganization at Moody's. And there were new heads of the structure of the ratings group. One was Don Noe, N-O-E, Don Noe, and Ken Pincus, P-I-N-K-E-S, were placed in charge of the ratings group. And that included all ratings, municipal, corporates, structured, sovereign, financial institutions. And they, at that time, promoted a whole bunch of people to managing director. I was at the tail end of that wave because I got promoted in 96 in November. But, you know, new heads of rating groups were all set. And that's what Brian Clarkson rose to his role as the head of structured finance.
Okay. Did structured finance rise to any level of import here at this time?
I think it was. It still was a relatively small. I mean, it wasn't. It wasn't the dominant source of revenues for the firm. No, okay. I think the bank rating groups and corporates were still earning more money than the structured at that point.
All right. What's the net effect of this change in culture?
Well, we became more focused on business. I use the term put pejoratively, that management became dominated by businessmen, and with less a focus on ratings quality. And I think by that time we were lulled into a bit of complacency because, frankly, since 1970, you know, there wasn't a whole lot of corporate distress. You had a recession in 1990. Defaults went up. That was pretty bad. But then they calmed down, and things were going along pretty well. You had the Asian crisis. That was a little bit of a wake-up call. But there weren't too many ratings that were wrong, or a couple of sovereign ratings. But corporate ratings did pretty well. The financial institution bank ratings did pretty well. We did not see
May I stop you there for a moment?
Certainly.
With this new corporate culture and this new interest in business, and you say business, and I've heard some others use the term business interest.
Okay.
Did you notice compensation changes throughout Moody's? I mean, did you suddenly make more? Were you incentivized differently?
Honestly, as long as we were owned by Dun & Bradstreet, I'd say, you know, we knew we made more money than our counterparts at other rating agencies, or certainly at S&P. I can't speak for Fitch. But it wasn't, no one was thinking they were going to get rich working at Moody's. I put it in those terms. You know, the salaries were well below Wall Street levels. There wasn't, and even to this day, Moody's never put a lot of emphasis on cash bonuses. The majority of your take-home pay was composed of your base salary. The bonus could have been maybe up to 20-30% more, additional, but you know, nowhere near as much as your base.
All right.
Maybe up to 50% of your base. But in 2000, when we became public, and I was given stock options, by the way, in Dun & Bradstreet from 1994 on. So they were given stock options from 94 to 2000. As far as I know, those options were worthless. I put them in the drawer and forgot about them. I didn't think that was going to amount to anything. But once Moody separated and became a public company in 2000, well, all of us and its managing directors, we got a big chunk of stock options. And from then on, our salary became, you know, our pay was highly driven by stock options. I would say highly driven. We got stock options. We had little control over it. Managers picked how many stock options you got. But it turned out by 2005, 2006, you know, I've opened up my statement. I'm saying, oh my God, there's some, you know, millions of dollars in here. I'm thinking, well, geez, you know, there's some real money here.
Right, right.
So, and we, like, even those old DMB options, which were sitting there that were 10 years old or more, you know, they were suddenly worth something. So it was all kind of, you know, whoa. We're seeing management also focus on financial performance. Our stock options and our bonuses were driven by the financial performance of the firm.
Right. There was no individual component. It was tied.
There was yes, there was some, but I'd say there was a individuals were ranked on a 1 to 5 scoring system. Okay, the highest being a 5, and the rule was that you didn't give out many 5s.
Right.
Okay, I was a 5 for all my whole career until I started working for Chris, and Chris said, if you're an MD, you're just a 4. I'll never make you a 5 as an MD. So it didn't matter what I did. He kept me a 4. I was okay with that. But some of my staff I gave a 5 to. Others were you know, 4s and 3s and 2s and 1s.
If I could bring you back and you can talk about it, as an MD, what's an annual salary at Moody's?
When I was a managing director, I'd say it hovered between $200,000 and $300,000 as a base salary.
Okay. And is that, when you say 200 to 300, I mean, you started as a managing director in 96. So we're
Probably around 180 to 200,000 back then.
Okay. And then you finish up in 07, so you're around 300 at that point in time?
That's right.
Okay. And then you said, I think, 20 to 30% of your salary?
My bonus would have ranged from anywhere from about $30,000, $40,000 up to about $180,000.
Okay, and that's...
But I was a managing director. The managing directors had larger bonuses than the other... Let me just talk about the other staff, the other titles that we had. We had associates, we had analysts, senior analysts, assistant vice presidents, analysts. Then you had senior vice president, analysts. So anything... below, and then it was managing director. So the highest analyst level would have been a senior vice president.
Okay.
And my senior vice presidents, the most they would have made would have been maybe $240,000. That would have been a lot for a senior analyst.
Okay.
As a base salary. A bonus, they could have earned up to $100,000 as a bonus on top of that.
And then options.
Then options. The staff got options, but the managing directors got more options.
Okay, and
I was getting between 10,000 options, up to 10,000 or more options, per year.
Shares at strike price would have been the street price.
The strike price would have been the current price when the options were granted.
Okay,
but the options had 10-year lives.
Right.
So I had options granted, just for example, I think a little over 10,000 given to me when we went public, just as part of the event. In 2000, the stock split, but at the post split price, the options would have been written at $14.
Okay.
And you know, the stock price went up by early 2000. The stock price was at $72. So the difference was per share was, you know.
Just so I have a good snapshot on the managing director levels, in 96, your starting salary is $180,000 to $200,000.
Thereabouts, from base, my base salary.
Right, and your bonus at that time is?
Would have been about $30,000 or $40,000.
And what's the percent range as a managing director of bonus?
I am not sure of that, but it's as a percent of base,
right?
I'd say anywhere from, you know, based on my experience, anywhere from about 20 to 50%.
20 to 50, and that would
also be driven by the firm's performance. If the firm had a bad year, everyone's bonus was lower.
Okay, and how much could your individual performance boost that?
I think, you know, if you were 5, there was a multiple. So if you ranked the highest, there was a kicker. So maybe it could increase it another 20-30%.
Wow.
So I mean, I work for, well, anyway, that doesn't matter. But basically, there's a function that based on your rating, So you get a percentage increase, and you get a bonus percentage based on your rating. So it's very mathematical. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay.
But, you know, there's leeway in there, but generally, here's what they did. I think they figured they had a bonus pool of X. You know, how do we get this formula so that we can divide it up in a way that still incents people?
Okay.
And let me see. The individual component, would you have set a goal at the beginning of the rating period? And what sort of goal would that have been, if so?
My guess, it was fairly progressive, and that is, as you got a higher score, the amount of your individual score went higher, the amount of your bonus went up. By a significant amount.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5. You mean?
Yes.
Okay. Right. No. I guess what I'm trying to get at is if I'm your supervisor, what am I rating you on individually? Is it market share?
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Is it market share? Am I saying, hey, get me a bigger share of market? Is it a revenue goal? What's going into your individual component?
Okay, that would depend on each person. We had a standard evaluation form, and so each year, you know, the manager would fill out. Actually, I filled out my own evaluation form, and you know, and in it would have various objectives, and it would depend on the area you were in. But some of the objectives would be business related; others would be. You know, HR related, how you know, are you a good manager? Others would have been, rating quality, you know, did you get your ratings right? Are you doing a good job there? Obviously subjective measures, very few quantitative measures, but my understanding is that, you know, market share was an objective. It wasn't an objective where I was because we had 100% market share in the corporate area.
Okay.
For all intents and purposes. We rated every bank that was out there. But new business development, were you able to get new business, that might have been here. In the structured area, my understanding is, and you can subpoena, you know, folks in that area to get more clarity, but my understanding is that market share may have been, if not overtly in the performance measurement, would have been an objective, though, that they were graded on.
Let me ask a question specifically. I think, is the SEC survey public? That document we saw? Hold on one second here.
I'm not 100%
well,
sure.
Well, we'd seen something that indicated that before 2007, analysts were compensated somewhat based on who they rated by the issuers. But there was some relationship between analysts and pay. I guess that's the question. And that apparently got delinked at some point in 2007, I think.
Between what and pay? I'm sorry, between...
Well, the analysts and the issuer.
The issuer. There was a measure of issuer satisfaction. You know, we did market surveys. We hired a firm. I think it was Greenwich Associates, Greenwich Greenwich, to survey the buy side, the institutional buy side investors, and you know, ask who was your favorite rating agency. You know, who's doing a good job, you know, who would meet your needs in the future. And I think there might have been a similar one for issuers. I'm not sure. I can't remember. So the results of some of these surveys factored in at the group level, but not at the individual analyst level.
Okay. If we could move on from pay, I'm sure you'll be happy to, but because we've kind of put that one down. But you were in early on to building models for the RMBS market. The RMBS market, I guess, infamously imploded not so very long ago. I wonder if I could get your impressions of what went wrong. Were there errors in the methodologies and the assumptions and the models themselves?
Great question. my view is that the models probably were not up to date, but ultimately this was not a modeling error, at least for the RMBS. Let's separate the CDOs from the RMBS, okay?
Right.
For RMBS, I think you know, there was some modeling error, but ultimately I think it was, you know, a focus on business and business pressure, you know, market share, that removed any incentive to get the rating right. There was no one was really focused on the accuracy of these ratings at that time.
And let me, because that's the problem, and now I just want to talk about symptoms of that problem. How would that problem have shown itself inside Moody's? The number of ratings going up faster than the number of people hired to rate?
There was clearly a resource problem at Moody's. That is, first of all, they were not able to pay competitive wages relative to Wall Street.
Okay.
So as soon as they would hire a young analyst and train them, within a year or so, they would jump to Wall Street for triple the salary.
Okay, so the revolving door problem.
Exactly. So that was part of it. The second part is that they, you know, that they were not staffed to monitor existing ratings, seasoned ratings. So they were fully focused on rating new issues, originations, and then once the ratings were out there, there was very little monitoring of the ratings. They didn't have the staff or resources to monitor.
When you say monitoring, do you mean surveillance?
Yes. Surveillance, by surveillance, I mean, you know, on an active, you know, basis, you know, high frequency, monitoring the performance of the underlying loans and making sure that the rating levels are, in fact, consistent with the performance of those underlying, of that evolving performance.
Dr. Fons, if I could play devil's advocate with you for one moment, because I've heard this argument a lot. There are those who would say that surveillance wouldn't have mattered because the housing prices kept going up and up and up until they didn't. And at that time, you know, everything imploded because it was the first decrease in the value of the underlying assets was what made the market implode, and surveillance wouldn't have helped. How would you address that?
Well, that's a valid point, except that, first of all, you know, surveillance assumes that the rating was right in the first place. Okay? It doesn't assume it, but you're working off a historical rating. Housing prices peaked, as far as I am aware, in mid-2006. There was evidence of declining housing prices by fall of 2006. It was clear that underlying performance, was deviating from norms by late 2006, early 2007, across the board, particularly for subprime securities. There were no rating changes until, as far as I'm aware, until the summer of 2007.
Okay, excellent. So,
and then they were changed en masse as a group.
Started to decline in late 2006?
Late 2000, you're saying?
Housing prices peaked in late 2006. Performance started to begin, there were signs of performance deviating from historical norms occurring by early 2007 and certainly, I think, possibly by late 2006.
Okay. So we talked about symptoms, one being a revolving door of analysts.
Yep.
If we could go back to that for a moment, other symptoms of the underlying problem, this is a growth problem.
I think it's a growth problem. I mean, I recall being in a town hall meeting or a managing director's meeting in early 2007 where it was announced that we had 500 opens, that is, unfilled jobs.
Largely analysts?
For analysts that we need to recruit for. Okay? Not just in structure, but, I mean, across the firm.
Again,
so, I mean, there was a we were focused on growth at that time.
That, I'm sorry, the date.
That was probably January 2007.
Okay. Wow. To give us some perspective, sir, the total, you know, universe of analysts working for Moody's, approximately how many?
Okay. I'd say, all right, first of all, the firm had, as of 2007, early 2007, had roughly 3,000 employees, but that included many sectors that were not involved in rating companies or securities. So the true analyst population, I'm going to guess, was somewhere around 1,200 to 1,300.
And, wow, you had 500 vacancies?
500 open. Yeah.
Wow.
But the 500 open would have been in other things, probably, you know, developers, programmers, as well as analysts. But I just, and by the end, but just put in perspective, by the end of 2007, Moody's had announced layoff. They were going to lay off 275 people.
Right. So the
and then many people have been fired during that year. So.
Boy, sounds like the bubble in the market kind of created a bubble within Moody's.
Absolutely.
Okay. At this town hall meeting, who was presiding at the town hall meeting?
Ray McDaniel.
Ray McDaniel, and
yeah.
Was this
McDaniel?
He's the CEO.
CEO. He's the CEO, chairman of Moody's Corp, CEO of Moody's, CEO of Moody's Corp, and at the time president of Moody's Investor Service.
Right, and. If it's me and I'm a Moody's employee and I care about the future of the organization, I might have a thing or two to say about 500 openings out of a complement of 1,200. Was there some passion at this meeting?
Well, I would say the 500 would have been relative to the 3,000 employees.
Okay.
Not to the 1,200 analysts, but 1,300 analysts. Passion? No. I mean, I think it was. Wow, you know, I guess we're growing. This is, you know, the stock was still rising. The stock hadn't peaked. It was up to $72, you know. We're on a great run here.
Okay.
And thanks to structured finance, because most of this was structured finance, and particularly European structured finance, that was now our next frontier. This is where they were focused.
Let me ask you about that, about European structured finance. Well,
yep.
I guess, was the market in the U.S. starting to dry up?
I think it was starting to become saturated, I'll put it that way. But certainly, you know, I think they tapped every borrower pretty well. We were all tapped out, you know. So we had full, almost 100% coverage of every issuance. The corporate bond market, you know, issuance was not growing there. Financial institutions issuance was not really growing too much there. So the growth was in structured finance, and we saw the growth prospects being better in Europe than in the U.S.
Mr. Follins, let me ask you a question. You sort of stepped out of structured finance at Moody's in 96, right?
That's right.
And so then you, other than, I guess, in the credit committee, you weren't involved in directly rating structured
That's
finance
correct.
Deals anymore, right?
I had no rating responsibility for structured finance. In fact, I remember one meeting of the structured credit committee, an issue came up, and we started debating this particular issue, and I said, wait a second, you know, we're not a rating committee. We can't assign a rating to this security. And they all stopped and said, oh, yeah, you're right. But, you know, we're not going to rate.
Dr. Fons, this is Tom Borges. I've been kind of quiet. I have a series of questions for you as far as when you and your peers started, even though you were on the corporate side as opposed to the structured side, things were changing in the market in 2005 and 2006 dramatically from the underlying, you know, quality of the collateral, with 100% loan to value, with, you know, with the piggyback loans, with interest only, and also Reg AB came out. There were many different things that were hitting the market in 2005 and 2006. Your peers on the other side of the fence, were they discussing any of their concerns with you over lunch or whatever, that these things were developing in the market that they were uncomfortable with?
You know, that's a great question, Tom. You know, what struck me in hindsight was that I sat on this high-level structured credit committee, which you'd think would be dealing with such issues, and never once was it raised to this group or put on our agenda that the decline in quality that was going into pools, the impact possibly on ratings, other things. We talked about, you know, the mapping of the structured rating scale to, you know, default rates. We talked about everything but the you know, the elephant sitting on the table.
Why is that? Because this is where we have to get to the core of what we're looking at. Why was it allowed to not come up at all? Because, you know, I spoke to a number of analysts over the years, modelers and so on, with PhDs and so on, and they knew about these concerns back in 2005 and 2006. Everything from mortgage fraud, you know, going off the charts and everything else. But why didn't it get to the high-level committee level where you were? Why was it allowed not to go up there?
I don't know the answer, Tom. And I think, you know, again, I was struck by this, and I'm wondering, you know, it was just something they wanted to keep under the rug or whatnot. But you know, in my defense, I was not in a position, you know, I should have been, but I mean, I really was not in a position to know what we were rating. I mean, I didn't have access to the loan files. I didn't have access to the underlying collateral that were going to these ratings. I mean, everyone knew that you know, you could get a loan, you know, 1-800-MORTGAGE. But it wasn't clear to me that all that was, you know, ending up or being misrated. You know, I'm okay with seeing, you know, the declining loan standards, but the ratings ought to reflect it. And
who in your view would be the people that should have known?
Well, obviously the managers, the analysts and managers in the RMBS team.
Who are some of the names there?
Well, I'll tell you, the group managing director in charge of that team was a guy named Michael Kanes, K-A-N-E-S. He's now head of regulatory affairs and compliance.
Right, but also, who are some of the people below him that might have been aware of this stuff?
The analyst, I'm sure it would have been David Teicher, T-I-E-S-C-H-E-R. The Linda Stesny probably should have been aware. I think she was a managing director in the group, S-T-E-S-N-E-Y.
I'm sorry, I didn't get that. F is in Frank?
S-T-E-S-N-E-Y. Oh,
okay.
I think there would have been, now I've seen testimony guy Kornfeld. Is that Warren Kornfeld? You know, I think he might have been in the area, K-O-R-N-F-E-L-D, something like that. I wasn't, by the time, let me put this in perspective, when I was in the RMBS group, there may have been a dozen people working on RMBS. By 2005, 2006, there were well over 30 people, just residential mortgage pass-through analysts at Moody's. And, you know, the reporting structure got a little confused for me. I didn't know who was reporting to who or who, you know. I didn't have access to those teams. I wasn't really digging around in that area. I knew some of the people. I'd recognize the names. But I just didn't know who was exactly where everyone fit.
How about Pramila?
But I did know Michael Kanes.
Pramila Gupta? Is she somebody you know?
Pramila Gupta was an analyst in the area. She might have been a managing director. When I was there in 96, she was an analyst. And I believe you're right. She was promoted to managing director. So she would have been one of the people. Yep.
Is there another man named Jay Eisner, I think his name is?
Jay Eisbrook. Brook? No, or Jay Siegel. There's a Jay Siegel.
Yeah, Jay Siegel. He's the research person, right?
Jay Siegel was there. He also would have been managing director. Yep. So he was an analyst when I was in the RMBS group, as was Pramila, and Linda Stesny as well. And so those three at least remained and were promoted.
Okay. if I could take you back a moment, you were I was asking you about the symptoms of the problem. Did you have any more symptoms? I know some of your Moody's coworkers testified before Congress, like yourself, Eric Kolchinsky, Kolchinsky, Scott McCleskey, McCleskey, and they had a few things to say about conflicts of interest and credit policy group and whatnot.
Yeah, I think, you know, I mean, the main problem was, as I said, I'll be happy to tell you, I mean, I think that the firm became so focused, particularly the structured area, on revenues, on market share, and the ambitions of Brian Clarkson, and that they were willingly looked the other way, traded the firm's reputation for short-term profits.
Okay.
I mean, I ultimately think that's what happened, and I think it's sad because it was a terrific franchise. As, you know, the history, as our history efforts show us.
Let me ask you a little more focused question. I've heard tell that there's that analysts would allow like a 5% variance in collateral without a change in ratings on their methodology. Have you heard anything to that extent?
No, I haven't. I know that there were always that the rating committee had the ability to, you know, incorporate non-quantitative factors and to, you know, therefore to deviate from a model output. You know, but there are two things. A, the model was not correct, was not updated, and B, you know, the teams had faced market pressure. I think, you know, I mean, I don't know if this is true, but I believe, or I wouldn't doubt that this happened, and I've been told that it may have, is that the rating committee comes up with they come up with an enhancement level. You understand how it works, right?
Credit, sure.
Something's going to be AAA. So they come up with an enhancement level. In fact, the rating committee votes on an enhancement level, not on a rating. So they're voting on an enhancement level. And, you know, they present the result to an issuer, and the issuer comes back and says, I'm sorry, that's not good enough. And so a senior manager says back to the rating committee, try again.
Well, okay. Now you say you've heard tell of that, and you don't doubt that it happens. But
I don't doubt that it happens.
But you have no specific knowledge of that.
I do not. If I wanted to find it, I know how I would find it. But
and how is that, sir?
I would first of all I would look for every first of all it was practiced at Moody's, and I assume this was followed, is that every rating committee had a. There was a document, at least from 2002 or so on. Every rating committee had a summary document that had to be filed with the compliance team, okay, which described the transaction, the rating outcome, and the committee members who voted on it, and the date that it happened. What I would look for is any instance where a rating committee was reconvened, and assuming that was filed correctly, you would see the same transaction being rated again at some point,
and
shortly after the initial committee.
Let me get into the weeds with you a bit on that. What's the name of that document?
Scott would know. Scott McCleskey would know. Geez, it was like a rating, you know, some sort of rating summary form. It was a compliance form. It was a rating compliance form, something like that.
And then, if I'm looking for evidence that this thing was filed and then that it was refiled, is there a file number? Is it filed by the name of the issuer or?
Yeah, I think it's by the transaction name or issuer name rather than there any sort of, and every issuer or transaction has a number in Moody's database, but I don't know that it would how they're indexed or how they're linked.
Okay.
But, you know, and I'm just supposing that this thing might exist, if something like that happened. But you would need to look at, I would say, all of them, or a large sample of them, to just, you know, or ask for those that might have been rating committees that were reconvened. And it may be that they wouldn't have filled out this form until they got the final okay.
Right.
In other words, you may not have gotten the early committee.
Question for you there, though, and this, I'm just relying on your expertise here. It seems to me that you feel that what really caused the blow-up in the RMBS market wasn't these, you know, hey, how about coming back with a little less enhancement, but Moody's was moving at great speed in order to get market share, no? And sacrificed the accuracy of the rating. So more, you know, basically, I guess to make it a simpler question, if we wanted to get under the bell curve, the majority of the problem was the rating itself, not what maybe happened on the periphery with this credit enhancement.
I think that's right. Or another way to look at it, you know, presumably there was a model, a rating model. The question is, you know, where was that model overridden? Okay, and if the model was known to be incorrect, why wasn't it fixed?
Well, that was my follow-up question to when was the model overridden? Because if the model's in error, it doesn't need to be overridden.
That's right.
But also, Mr. Fong,
the models were progressively, and I understand this to be, you know, the case, were progressively, you know, neutered, or you know, they became progressively lax in order to maintain market share. And that's another thing one could look at. I mean, it'd be too complicated to explain simply, but it may be the case that one would put side by side the evolution in RMBS methodology, the models, and see if, in fact, there was any loosening of standards.
Right.
Through time.
Right. And that's I think, easy enough to do on its face. I don't know about the specifics of the models themselves, but that's easy enough to do.
To do that, you'd need the model. When I say models here, what I mean is not simply a published document that says, here's our methodology, but it would literally be software, you know, that is used to run, you know, the pools, the loan tapes through.
Okay, no, I did not understand it in that vein.
Okay.
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 But when we talk models, like that one that I mentioned earlier, the BET.
Yep.
That's the framework for a model. Do the various rating agencies add some proprietary component to that? Or are they all largely adhering to that model strictly?
Well, I mean, first of all, what that model is simply a tool to assess the degree of independence among various securities or assets. In other words, if I've got a collection of 50 securities or assets, and I'm going to collateralize them, put them in a pool, I'd like to know to what extent are they going to mimic each other in performance, or are they sufficiently different? And that is, when one performs badly, the other does well. Okay, so the more independent they are, that is, that they move differently, the more comfort I can have that this thing wouldn't just tank all at once.
Okay.
So the idea of this model is to gauge that degree of dependence.
That's the degree of correlation?
Exactly. But correlation is a funny term. So, heuristically, you know what it means. But technically, there are many ways to look at correlation of credit risk.
Okay. Tom, did you have Mr. Borgers, did you have something?
Yes, Dr. Fund. If you were in charge of the RMBS area during this time, and I know you've probably learned a lot over the years since the crisis started and before, do you think that under your watch that these ratings could have gone out of your shop the way they the way they did?
If I was in charge of the RMBS ratings or in charge of all of structured finance?
You could take either or.
Okay. If I was in charge of the RMBS ratings, they would not have gone out, and I would have lost my job. Okay. But if I was in charge of all of structured finance, then I could say they would not have gone out, and I might have lost my job again because we have been losing market share, and we would not have, I'd be put in a tough position. I'd have to defend a conservative methodology and approach in the face of a booming mania.
So would you say that most analysts who are very qualified with their, you know, their backgrounds were afraid to speak out?
I think that's safe. I mean, I'm pretty sure that no analyst woke up any morning and said, let's put out some crappy ratings today. That it was institutional pressure, that they, you know, they wanted to keep their jobs, and they didn't see, you know, they couldn't see the eventual outcome of all this, okay? But, you know, they did, they knew that they were being bullied into caving into bank pressure from the investment banks and originators of these things. And I think, you know, and this was clear to me after I left Moody's, when, in fact, they kept all of the people, these analysts and managing directors there at the firm.
Mr.
And they were
Fines,
firing people who had, yes.
The bullying, again, we have maybe a disease here. What are the symptoms of the bullying? How does Moody's get bullied?
Well, I mean, it's Moody's allowed itself to be bullied. And you know, they willingly played the game is how they were bullied.
Okay.
They could have stood up and said, I'm sorry, this is not, you know, we're not going to sign off on this. We're going to protect investors. We're going to stop, you know, we're going to try to protect our reputation. We're not going to rate these CDOs. We're not going to rate these RMBS, you know, subprime RMBS, you know, we're not going to give you the enhancement levels that you want. Therefore, we're not going to be on the deal.
Right.
Therefore, the deal's going to get done, and we're going to be irrelevant. So this is the position they were in. And the personality, internal bullying, was simply part of the personality of Brian Clarkson.
Now, have you heard over the years through your peers and your network within Moody's that a number of people who were voicing their opinion were demoted or reorganized out of a job?
I think the first example of that would have been Mark Adelson. That's Adelson, or Adelson, who is now the chief risk officer at Standard & Poor's. Mark Adelson was in the RMBS area, I believe, up to around 99 or 2000, and he refused to cave in to pressure to increase market share, and was forced to a different area, and he quit. And he went to Nomura, and then he's back now. He's at S&P.
Do you have any other examples?
The obviously, I've heard Eric Holshinsky's story, and he claims a similar thing there. Again, the folks. Let me just tell you a little about the culture in structured finance. The way that Brian ran it is that Brian Clarkson picked people who were unquestioningly loyal to him. If you were to challenge him or challenge his motives
Dr. Fons?
Yes.
Who were some of his unquestioningly loyal employees?
Well, clearly the folks, Noel Kernan.
Right.
Right under him. Michael Caniff, example. And all of the senior managers who were in structured would have been in that would have met that criteria.
Okay.
Otherwise, they would have been gone.
And when, you know, you didn't work directly for Brian Clarkson.
I did in 95, early 90s. In fact, Brian Clarkson promoted me to managing director.
Okay. Did you have...
And I knew him well.
Did you have...
He also fired me, by the way. Okay.
Well, yeah, I wanted to get there. I wanted to to get to August of 07. But before that, I just wanted to say, did you have any direct contact with Mr. Caniff or Clarkson or whatnot where you're more or less being bullied?
I'll tell you, I can tell you an episode just as an aside, and I hope we don't get too much into it, but as I told you early on, I was chair of the Symbols and Definitions Committee. One of the rating symbols that appeared to be one of the rating practices that was being used in structured finance raised concern in the regulatory affairs area after I'd left regulatory affairs. And so I started looking into it. It had to do with the assignment of what are called provisional ratings. Okay, and these are pre-ratings, widely used and structured at the time for to help market pre-market new transactions. I started to look into this as in my role as head of the Symbol Definite Committee, asked about their practices. I was told, butt out, I'm bad for business, get away. And this was Brian's direct words to me, you're bad for business. And I'm pretty sure that's why I was fired as soon as he became president.
Okay, so we go to August 07, and yep. how does your termination occur?
At the beginning of August 07, Ray promotes Brian to be president. Brian previously had been executive vice president and co-chief operating officer. My boss, Chris Mahoney, was also executive vice president, co-chief operating officer. So the two of them were, you know, rivals, heads, the Chris in charge of fundamental and Brian in charge of structure. As soon as I learned early that Brian was going to be president, actually I only learned like a couple weeks before, and I knew something was going on, but I knew there was a reorganization coming, but I didn't know exactly what would happen. So when he became president, he started telling Andrew Kimball, who became my boss right at the beginning of August, that he doesn't know if there's going to be room for Jerry in the organization now. And Andrew is completely shocked. Andrew thinks I'm one of the most valuable people at Moody's. He wrote an email to the entire company the day after I left, and he almost got himself fired over it because he said, you know, we lost Jerry, blah, 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 he did all this stuff. Andrew can't believe this, that Brian's saying Jerry's, you know, there's no room for Jerry. And come August 18th, you know, Andrew was told, you have to go fire him. So probably one of the toughest things Andrew did, because Andrew hired me in 1990. And we worked together closely, and we had great respect for each other. And so Andrew, you know, walked me down to HR and said, you're being terminated. And I was like, I had to comfort him, because I felt so bad, you know, for him having to do this, because I just, you know, I knew this was Brian, and this wasn't him.
All right.
And it was just, you know, it was tragic. And so my boss, Chris, was also fired. Chester Murray was fired. You know, a number of people were fired who had nothing to do with the subprime loan.
Right. Let me ask you a few mopping up questions.
Sure.
Number one, do you maintain contact with anybody from your Moody's days, any former Moody's employees?
I had dinner once every 6 months or so with Chris Mahoney.
All right.
Do we know him?
I have spoken to... I don't think I'm welcome there. I was invited to their alumni party right before I testified, and I testified and I realized I shouldn't show up in front of Congress, so I haven't gone to that. When I see people, and I have called Richard Cantor, I've talked to him maybe in December, but we're buddies. We were buddies. I bought him the Moody's from the New York Fed. We were economists. But otherwise, I do not talk to many current people, but many ex-employees, yeah. I there's a network of us that we do talk.
I'd be particularly, what I'd like to do is send you maybe a follow-up email just regarding former Moody's employees, potentially. I'm most interested in structured. If you could get back to me with contact information, names, contact information, what I'll do is I'll follow up this recorded interview with just an email to you asking for contact information and names of former structured employees.
Okay.
All right. Secondly, the history of Moody's that you put together. Did you provide that to Congress prior to your testimony?
I did not.
Could I ask you for a copy of that?
Yes. Would be easiest. Yeah, I can have one. We have one made. I can have one made.
I'd appreciate it. And what I'll do, I'll give you my email. Will have my return information on it.
Okay.
All right. All right. Go ahead.
Yes, and that would include both the what was just hard copy and the soft copy.
It was just a hard copy. I mean, I have some of the chapters, but they were not fully edited. I have about 10 of the chapters. I could possibly email you those.
Yeah, that would be great if you could.
Okay. I do have those. It's not the complete set, though. It's just like a number of them.
Right. Yeah, if you could follow that up with the hard copy, that would be great. Mr. McWilliams has two or three mopping up questions for you.
Okay.
I've heard that the servicer for the various issues played a role in your ratings, or it could play a role. Did it play a role in your ratings?
Well, Moody's issued, being the head of the Symbols and Definition Committee and writing the book on it, we issued what we called servicer quality ratings. It was a scale like SQ1 to 5, something like that. And so part of when I was in the RMBS group and the practice continued, part of what we did was we did what we called operational reviews, op reviews, of servicers and originators. And we would go around and we would visit with them and ask them questions about their practices and systems and so forth, capabilities. And that would go into a rating that somehow, according to the methodology, impacted the enhancement level that was required for a pool.
Do you remember who had a bad service quality rating?
No.
Oh, okay. That's probably a little more present also. Yeah. So that's interesting. At Kroll,
those ratings should be public. You could be able to look them up.
Okay. At Kroll, are you investigating anything related to the mortgage business?
No. Yeah. We are working. I mean, we have been retained to do some things like that that Kroll Investigation has, but I'm working with the rating group, and no, I'm not really doing that.
Okay. There was a news article not so long ago that said that two employees contacted Warren Buffett about Moody's, I think in 07. Do you know who those employees were?
I wrote him a letter, he just got back. I don't think his secretary is very nice, saying, Mr. Buffett read your letter, but he's not interested.
When was this?
Probably, that would have been 08, by the way, probably March, February 08.
So you were a former employee at that point?
Yeah.
So that
I would never reached out to him as a current, when I was a current employee, no.
Yeah, I'm not clear. I can't remember if the article said former or current. Were you the source for that on the McClatchy article?
No, I wasn't. I think the reporter might have asked me about that one, but I wasn't the other person. I don't know who the other one was. I didn't ask.
So, okay. Also, do you know, and this is probably more for the current RMBS people, do you know any transactions where the collateral was misstated or was fraudulent, or were they changed any aspects of the transaction, like termination triggers or various sort of details of the transaction which would basically change it and make it less valuable?
I would not know about that. And as far as I know, the firm, and this is, you know, the rating agencies claim not to do due diligence, so they were not looking for fraud. They were not looking for these other things. So I don't know about that.
Okay.
Hey, Dr. Fons, I just remembered something. You mentioned a town hall meeting, and in having an interview with another Moody's employee, they mentioned a town hall meeting in which I guess this was in the middle of, you know, when the market started to lock up. Allegedly, the CFO was speaking at a town hall meeting and basically was talking about revenue. And supposedly one of the managing directors spoke up and said, you know, hey, this market is melting down, and we've basically been, you know, a part to helping it to this point, and we're still talking about revenue. Do you recall?
Absolutely. That was, by the way, that the transcript from that town hall meeting was, it should still be on the House Oversight Committee website.
Okay.
Pertaining to the hearings. That I was part of.
Okay.
I do have a copy of the transcript on my PC here, but it's on their website, and it was from, I believe, September 2007.
Okay.
And it was, I can even tell you who that was. I think that must have been Greg Bauer who would have asked that question, Bauer.
Excellent.
But just sounded like something he would do.
Okay, no, I'm glad I asked then. It was itching at the back of my mind.
Okay.
Mr. Borgers, do you have anything else before we say thank you to Mr. Fonz?
I actually know, Vic and Bruce, I would have some final question or questions. What would you recommend our activities include, which you haven't mentioned yet, to get better clarity and what caused the financial crisis, especially within Moody's?
I mean, I don't really know exactly the scope of what you're doing is here, or how you're planning on moving forward. So if I knew a little bit of more, you know, more about what you are doing, I mean, I might be able to answer that better. So, you know, it's a difficult problem. You're going to, so far, a lot of people, I call them, they're in the witness protection program within the firm. The lawyers have been in charge. They have, you know, and this has led to my frustration and the market's frustration. You know, clearly there was some mistakes made, things were done wrong, yet the firm has been in denial and finger pointing and blame shifting, and you know, it just gives the impression of zero, and they've been hiding behind the First Amendment shield, so it gives the impression of there's no accountability whatsoever. And I think that's the most frustrating part to people. You know, you'd like to see, you know, some acknowledgement of what's happened. You'd like to see someone take responsibility. You'd wonder why the CEO is still there. Why are the board of directors still there? Where were they? What's going on here? You know, and are they just so focused on these lawsuits that they're facing that they can't talk and they can't do anything, that they're paralyzed? And they can't even change, they can't even prove what they're doing because of these lawsuits. I'd just like to know if that's what's going on.
Okay. Anything else, Mr.
Okay,
Rogers?
And what about documents? So, would there be any specific documents that you would recommend us looking at to get a better understanding?
You know, I just don't see any smoking gun documents around that you're going to be able to find. There may be some, but the SEC has been through the emails. They found the, you know, the cows one, you know, the House of Cards thing from the S&P people. I think Moody's people are probably a little more careful with their emails. We had been subject to the Department of Justice investigation, and you know, we had a lot of training in document destruction and retention. So I think, you know, they're probably pretty careful.
Okay. Dr. Fonz, just two things. One, anything that comes before the commission, we ask that you keep it confidential, both matters that you discuss and matters that we questioned you on. Number one. And number two, I just want to thank you very much for your time. And I'm gonna terminate the interview. I'm gonna terminate the recording at this point. The time is 11:44 a.m.